What up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of The Render Bar. My name is Steve Jax.
I'm Richard Sanchez.
And we are two VFX editors working in Hollywood in features and television, here to talk all things visual effects, editing, and industry related. Today, we're going to be talking about what does a VFX editor actually do? We'll be checking in on our union benefits, and we'll wrap it out with some talk on PAs in the cutting room. But first, Richard, let's get an industry check-in. What's going on?
You know, it's interesting. We're still in the post-strike era, and the slowdown that's come with that really has not entirely bounced back, but I have noticed several friends getting interviews. So I think we are starting to come back. We are certainly not where we were in 2019, 2020, and it's hard to say whether we ever will be. I think there are signs to be optimistic about. One thing I found really interesting is I had a friend recently who reached out to me and was asking me to help them find a VFX editor in the UK. And I had been under the assumption that things were pretty rough and anemic all around. And I found actually, I reached out to probably 12 or 13 VFX editors, and I only got 3 resumes, which to me says there's a lot of people working in the UK. Now, I'm very happy for our colleagues working on the other side of the pond, but I do think domestically it certainly makes me a little concerned. We all know that there are a lot of shows that are either leaving the state of California, leaving New York, and leaving the country. And I think there is room for everybody, but it would represent a seismic shift. And the sheer number of resumes that I got back, or rather that I didn't get, speaks to a lot of numbers going overseas.
In terms of people working overseas and leaving here to work over there.
It's debatable whether that actually accounts to work having left, because of course there's work naturally in the UK. So yes, that is debatable. Is this the result of work having left the States for the UK, or is this just work naturally that would have been in the UK? But we do know that there are a lot of tax incentives that are being chased, which is leading people to the UK.
I know of at least one show where they're shooting in London, but they're luckily enough for a lot of locals. There are some people I know that are able to work on that show locally until they wrap out on production, until maybe they come back here for post.
Yeah.
And then I know a friend of mine recently was up for a few interviews, didn't work out, but she ultimately got something else. And I have another friend that is wrapping one film and moving on to a series. So I do know people in my circles that are getting work. And that's a really great thing to hear. I'm glad that I'm seeing people move from one thing to another and they're not floundering, but there are a lot of people still not getting work. And I know recently there was a VFX meetup that we both sadly missed. And we would love to hear from folks like you that are, maybe if you're looking for work or struggling for work, just to hear your thoughts on everything and what you might be experiencing in this time.
And it's worth noting, as VFX editors, we work dominantly in the feature and or scripted space. And I know from talking to folks in the unscripted world still really seems to be suffering. And that's another thing that that breaks my heart quite a bit, because I got my start in unscripted. And I think unscripted is a great training ground. And so I have noticed that there is a trend that the unscripted world is rather anemic right now. And I think it's just one of those things where we're all in this together, and we want to be there for our community, help out where we can, reach out to your friends. I think there's something to be said about reaching out to people who are out of work, but really reaching out to people as friends, just checking in, I think is how we're going to keep each other getting through this, because it's rough still. I think a lot of us thought it'd be turning around by now.
I know there's a lot of people that might say, yeah, it's nice to reach out as a friend, but I need a job.
Yeah. No, you're not wrong.
You know, and that's a big struggle. But you gotta, I guess, keep the faith and keep holding out that something else will come about. In a lot of ways, industry-wide, I'm seeing obviously there's a big shift between so many productions happening to now dwindling down. And in one way, I think that's like, sucks for the worker, but good for the industry in a way, in terms of we have had so much so many films and shows being just pumped out to the point where I'm like, no one can watch all of this at the same time.
Yeah.
An abundance of shows.
Yeah.
And I think that has led a little bit to the nature of the industry being like, what is happening? What are we doing in Hollywood? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
We're chasing this immediate buck of streaming, and which has now kind of led to a place of stagnant, less productions happening just because they're not seeing it as cost effective as they once did.
Hold for Airplane. That's what we get for recording outdoors.
We're doing it live. Yeah. And so in one way I'll see it as it's nice to see that maybe Hollywood is kind of saying, let's rethink this. Sadly, it affects the workers.
Yes.
You know, and as much as everyone, you look back 10, 15 years ago, I don't know what, I don't have all the numbers in front of me, and I'm not one to be able to purport that I know a lot about statistics and things in the industry, but you could argue that are we back in a place that we once were? In that during COVID, during pandemic, in the past 5 years, there was such a big boom that suddenly felt normal, but that really wasn't.
Yeah.
Do you feel like where we're at now is maybe anywhere we were used to be, or is this still like this big deficit?
I would say, in my opinion, it is still at a deficit. It's
still even worse than that.
Yeah. There was still, you still had to, my general principle was always when you get to about a month and a half away from your job ending, you start reaching out to people. And of course, building your network of people who you can reach out to takes time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, by the time I had established myself even moderately, you could make two or three phone calls and odds are, I think I know somebody, or maybe even you pick up for something for 2 weeks. Someone just took a vacation and there was something to be had.
Yeah.
Maybe you took a rate lower than you wanted to for a short period, but you had something to keep you working. Or if you were a union, you might take a non-union gig for just a short run. You had something, and the amount of people who call me, whom I am flabbergasted by how talented they are and just shocked that they are without work, it still surprises me.
Yeah, for sure.
Even speaking for myself, I am in the fortunate position to be leaving a project for another project, and in doing so was able to replace myself, pass off the last remaining few weeks of my gig to transition into another. So, I mean, it speaks to work there, but also it feels like the people who I see working consistently are those people who have very much embedded themselves in the higher end level. I've seen a lot of people who regularly work tent poles working, and I think that's largely because tent poles typically work for 12 to 14 months. They're very long-term gigs, and typically when you embed yourself in those world, you tend to work there consistently. And of course, new people can come into the fold as people rotate, but there's far less rotation happening because there's far less jobs. And that will lead to a bit more of a closed shop ecosystem.
Right, right. Yeah, I would say that too. A lot of my friends work on larger tentpole things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm happy that you're moving on to something.
Thank you.
Just that says that there are things out there. And again, to keeping in check with people and keeping up with people and seeing what's going on.
Yeah.
Is the best way to, you know, make sure that maybe you're in the right place at the right time for someone to need someone and you happen to be that person.
Yeah. But speaking of the industry as a whole, Minecraft, blew away box offices, which actually, I don't know if you heard this story about Minecraft. It was really sweet. And I don't know that it solely originated in the Facebook group Crew Stories. I imagine that was just one avenue. But there was a young child who was terminally ill and was a large fan of Minecraft. And I definitely saw it within the Crew Stories group. Everyone was reaching out, who's working on this film? We got to find out who's on this film. We're going to get this kid a chance to see the movie. And the kid got to see the movie. It was so sweet.
Really?
And I believe Jason Momoa even reached out to him. Just a wonderful moment within a tough time for all of us. But, you know, I think Minecraft I think Minecraft's success also illuminates something, too, about the current state of films. I think a lot of people, myself included, had been saying things like, this generation of kids don't watch movies. They are watching YouTube. They're watching the digital creator-based material, and they're playing video games. And I think Minecraft kind of comes out of that to say, younger folks will watch movies. You just have to make movies that they watch. And I am constantly surprised, having been raised largely in the 90s, how much 90s nostalgia there is. And look,
oh my God.
Don't get me wrong. I will listen to the Gin Blossoms all day long. And
that's what you go to, the Gin Blossoms?
You know, I mean, you know, and sequels to those. Like, I love my 90s, but if you're not going to appeal to what kids are watching, and again, those kids, I feel old even just saying that, but...
It's the truth, though. I mean, kids, we're not making movies for kids.
We're
making movies for adults who were kids.
Yeah.
We're making so much 80s and 90s nostalgia going toward that are aimed for kids.
Yeah.
A Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon for kids, but
yeah,
also that parents would want to see too. Or a Barbie movie for adults.
Yeah.
That kids, that great for young girls as well. Or
both great examples. Both, I love both of them.
You know, we're still making Transformers movies. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
we're still trying to make these, hold on to these IPs,
mm-hmm,
rather than make something for kids of today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what reached audiences with Minecraft, is that here's nostalgia from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Not 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So kids that are like Gen Z kids have nostalgia for something 10 years ago when they first started playing Minecraft.
Yeah.
Like, my nephew is that age. He's 15, 13? No, mm-hmm. I don't know. He's 14. And he loves Minecraft. He loved the movie. He was so excited to go see it. So it's for kids like that in their teenagers or early 20s where they played this 10 years ago as kids, and now they're growing up and now they get to see it on screen.
Yeah.
So it's the first time I've seen it in quite a while. And I'm sure there's examples of this, but it seems to me, at least in the box office results, it made $162 million its first weekend. It made another $80 million this weekend.
Yeah.
That, like, it's insane that many... It proves that people still want to go to the theater. Kids still want to go to the theater. It's proof that you can still make movies that people want to go to.
Yeah.
That people will get off their couch and go to the theater.
Yeah.
And the fact that this movie is for kids, it's not for adults.
Yeah.
And I heard reviews at first. I haven't seen it yet, but I heard reviews. Maybe the rumor I heard wasn't that great, but then I heard reviews afterward that it's a kids' movie.
Yeah.
What do you want it to be?
Yeah.
You know, kids are loving it. They're going crazy in the theater. That's another topic of how crazy they're going in the theater. And I think that has a lot to do with their connection with social media and content creation. Have you heard of this?
I haven't heard
how
they were going crazy.
Okay, so there's been kids in theaters going wild over a particular scene that depicts a viral moment in the game, maybe like a Easter egg moment in the game that rarely happens. But they put it in the film and the kids go nuts.
Okay.
And it has to do with a mini Frankenstein.
Okay.
Riding a chicken.
Oh, I've seen the.
And they call it Chicken Jockey.
Social media has been pushing that that clip.
Right. So the kids go nuts. Kids are jumping in the theater, putting their friend on top of their shoulders.
Oh, wow.
In the theater, jumping up, throwing popcorn, and being crazy and causing a mess. So theater owners are very upset about this.
Yeah, that wouldn't thrill me.
You know, I understand that. And having worked in a theater, that would really suck. However...
The excitement.
I'm not going to get too upset about it. It's a weird way to, I think that's a bigger topic about how Gen Z and younger people, not just a generation, but younger people.
Yeah.
How they're reacting and how they're behaving in that social setting of a theater.
Yeah.
And taking it more into I want to not watch something, but also create something while I'm watching something.
Yeah.
And make it go viral. I don't know what to do with that. I don't know how to take that in yet.
Yeah.
I'm still pondering that. Like, what is that? It's a very strange thing versus, you know, we would see, you know, when we first saw the Spider-Man movie 20 years ago, I was like, what? And we probably, you know, when Avengers comes out, we're all like cheering and all these things. Star Wars, obviously. You go back to the, you know, Phantom Menace came out. Even in the Return of the Jedi back in the 80s. Yes, fans are going nuts. But this is a very different thing that we're seeing.
Yeah.
In which fans are filming themselves doing a bit or doing a stunt in the theater.
Yeah, I gotta admit.
Throwing popcorn up in the air.
As an old curmudgeon, that I'm not okay with that. That's one of those things where if you're there to see a movie and take on a collective experience, do that. But don't make it about you, because it's not about you. I didn't spend $15 to watch you film yourself throwing popcorn.
Yeah. I think that goes into how theaters should be run.
Yeah.
Which could be, and I won't get too much into it, but I think it's basically if theater owners were able to have their staff introduce the film to the audience.
Arclight
have somebody
style.
Right, the Arclight used to do that. Just some presence that there are people here that work here versus this screen.
Yeah.
This auditorium that, like, you don't see anybody working there.
Yeah.
And then you maybe feel like you have the free reign to do whatever you want. Yeah. I don't know. That might not be the answer, but it's a thought.
Yeah.
So let's get into some other topics of the day.
Yeah, we got a special one.
We got a special one. Do you want to introduce this one?
Yeah, we're going to call this segment, Who is your VFX editor and what does he do?
Ah, that was perfect. That was a spot on impression. Go to the chopper.
You were supposed to set me up so I could say, it's not a tumor. I don't do a very good Arnold.
That's not a timeline. I don't know.
It's not a timeline.
So this came up because I recently had somebody reach out to me asking about some VFX editing work, and I had to clarify with them what exactly they wanted, because I got the impression that they wanted a compositor, someone to do VFX artistic work.
Yeah.
Not VFX editing work. And as we know, and as you listeners, if you are VFX editors, you're aware that there's a big difference between a VFX editor and a VFX artist.
Yeah.
And that is something that I found a lot of people don't really understand the difference of. So why don't we get into some of those differences?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the first one that jumps out at me is if you're a VFX editor working at a VFX vendor, it's a very different beast from if you're a VFX editor working on the production itself. I mean, I think the starkest difference is working at a vendor, you will always be non-union. And working on a production, you'll probably be union. I mean, the Motion Picture Editors Guild just finally added a VFX editor designation, and so there's a rather big distinction there. But likewise, what a VFX editor does working for a vendor versus working on a show is going to vary quite a bit. And I've never worked at a vendor, but I've talked to enough VFX editors vendor side to just have a rough idea. From my perspective, they've taken in the cuts that we've sent them. If you're only giving that vendor, say, a couple of sequences, they'll take that sequence, they'll generally overcut each of their successive versions into that so they can look at their shots as they're delivered in context, and that helps them determine what does get sent back to the client, i.e. us in production. And their job, they'll usually also double check to see if anything in the cut has changed. While that's primarily our job in production, you know, I've certainly had VFX editors, hey, we noticed this shot changed. And I'm sure you've experienced this yourself where, you know, oh yeah, the shot length seems different. And then we are often running interference. Like, yes, it's changed, but I don't know if that change is going to stick yet. So don't update anything. I haven't told you about that for a reason.
And to jump, to kind of take us, that's all great. And to take a step a little bit further back from that, I would want to get into the difference between a VFX editor and a VFX compositor.
Oh,
because what you're talking about is a VFX editor on client side versus VFX editor on vendor side, which has a distinct, those are two distinct positions as well. But in terms of even saying, what does a VFX editor do that the layman, say a producer or director is trying to, a producer is right on a small budget thing.
Yeah.
Saying like, I need VFX on my show. And they see that you, Richard, have on your resume VFX editor. Oh, well, you're a VFX guy. I can talk to you about anything VFX. You must be able to do all the VFX work I need for my show.
Yeah.
And so the difference, though, between being someone who can finalize creative shots in After Effects or Blender or Nuke or something to create something that is a final product, understanding lighting, understanding compositing, understanding animation.
Yeah.
Very different thing than a VFX editor.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say the distinction is a VFX editor is one that works with the editor,
mm-hmm.
one that tracks the different shots in the mm-hmm. cut as they're changing, as the cut is morphing, being able to create temporary composites mm-hmm. to sell your idea to a vendor, mm-hmm. or if it's on a smaller budget scale, to just a VFX artist.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a temp comp, give it to you. Now you make it look
yeah.
sweeter. You use your skills as an artist to make it look crisp, final, the right color, the right space, the yeah. shading, the right everything.
Here's my proof of concept. You take this and make it fly.
Yeah. And so when anyone is asking for a VFX editor, what they should be thinking more in terms of a VFX artist.
Yes.
So that when folks out there that are trying to make their small short films or short product projects, that they understand that distinction, and so that they know what they're asking for.
Yeah.
You know, you find out that a lot of people just don't really know what they're asking for when they ask for that.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest distinctions, you know, I've had is people ask me as a VFX editor, do I need to know Nuke or After Effects? And in your experience, what would you say to that?
For a VFX editor?
Yeah.
I would say Nuke? No.
Yeah.
After Effects, highly recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need it to complete your job? I would say no. You can do a lot of work in Avid. Does it help? Yes.
Yeah. My philosophy has always been whenever absolutely possible, I am an advocate for doing things in Avid, mainly because it allows us to track the assets, because as VFX editors, we need to deliver those to a vendor. But there's something to be said of if you can't create a temp comp that is sufficient enough to sell the idea in Avid, you do need to move something to something like After Effects that's more robust, just to go, this is the idea I'm selling. This is my, again, my rough proof of concept.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just need those tools in After Effects.
And you could do a lot more in After Effects you can do in Avid.
Yeah.
In a lot cleaner, smoother, effective way, organization-wise, and you have more tools in there that you don't in Avid. After Effects is a lot more user-friendly when it comes to those doing temp comps or just composites in general.
Yeah.
I've noticed I've more recently jumped back into After Effects after a while of just doing work in Avid.
Yeah.
That has a lot to do with time.
Yeah.
How much time do you have to get the work out?
Yeah.
Between the editor getting a director approval on a cut.
Yeah.
The editor giving you the shots to do the temp work on. To turning that over to the vendor.
Yeah.
And then how long is it sitting with the vendor before they send stuff back? So that time, if it's a short amount of time, then maybe your temp work is just that, temp. And it's a slap comp. It is very quick and dirty
yeah.
to get the idea. And that's okay because everyone is aware the time, your schedule's short, it gets out quick, it's kind of come back from the vendor. And there's no point to start tweaking and analyzing your temp comp when you're not doing it, if you're not doing a screening, especially.
Yeah.
Versus show them on now as a feature. We have a long time between a temp, whenever the director approves the scene, to when we may even turn over the scene, let alone start to get shots back.
Yeah.
So I'm finding that jumping into After Effects, doing a lot more cleaner work is something that's happening a lot on this show, which is great because it's kind of getting those skills back in gear for me because I've been out of the After Effects loop for a while.
Yeah.
And previously I would have argued that you don't need After Effects. You can do it all in the Avid. And like you said, because yes, you can keep track of all your clips, all your slates, everything that was used so you can pull it and deliver it to your vendor.
Yeah.
But with Avid or with After Effects, I found my own little tricks and techniques of making sure that in my temp comps, I am putting that slate there.
Yeah.
I'm adding a little the clip name on screen. I'm adding my frame counter. I'm also almost treating it like I am a VFX artist delivering a shot.
Yeah.
Just because that's the nature of what we do. I'm used to seeing the frame counter. I'm used to seeing the burn-in of who did the shot, when they did it, you know, things like that. Versioning it and everything. So I do take that seriously, and I find it helps a lot so that even if I may not have all of those takes, if it's a bunch of split-screen comps or elements that I'm compositing,
yeah,
that even if they aren't there in the timeline, on burned in on that shot are all those elements with the time code. So I can easily find it.
Yeah, which that's a really good hint for folks working in After Effects, because that's always my biggest issue with bringing After Effects into VFX editing is, one, the minute you come into After Effects, you've lost connection to your original assets and time code. So it's harder to track that unless you have the foresight to put that information, burn it into your comp somewhere so you can refer to that. And certainly when organizing your Avid timeline, that you don't blow away your plates, because you need to keep track of those. The comp is just the idea. The plates are what's going to make it up. But you touched on time, and I think that's always the thing. I think back to, I was working on a film that took place largely in the future and partially in hell. And so these were giant green screen sets. And it was one of those things where I could have brought those into After Effects and really rotoed their edges nice. But when I first came on, I came in well into the editing process. We were just about to deliver a director's cut. And at the time I said, I'm keeping this in the Avid so I can just jam. So I can do, if I can knock out, say, 30 to 40 slap comps a day, if that means we can deliver the director's cut. And at the very least, I can just say, here is a rough interpretation of the future, you know? Yeah, maybe the tracking of the backgrounds is not even all that great, but it's better than just looking at green screen.
And it also depends on knowing the expectations of your team.
Yeah.
You know, what your director expects, what your producers expect.
Yeah.
Are you doing a screening? Do you need to put these comps together more nicely for audience?
Yeah.
So that they have no question of what they're looking at.
Yeah.
Because that affects feedback.
Very much so. Yeah. And there is certainly something to be said. I was listening to an interview with Sam Restivo, who we've had on our show. He was talking about the process of working on Gladiator 2. And it was the story where he said, working with Ridley would always say, just cut it real rough. I can watch it rough. And the interviewer said, now, do you actually cut it rough or do you polish it? And he said, oh, we always say, yeah, sure, no problem. And then you polish it. It's like, yes,
it's in your nature.
Something to be said, you know, and you know what they, you know,
right.
There is a spectrum of roughness you can get away with. And that is the balance of time to, I can't show, I'm showing this to a head up, you know, big producer. It's not that they can't imagine things, but it is that I need you to see this with some polish.
Yeah. And it's good to communicate what you're updating to, say you're giving shots to your editor, new temps that you're doing, to make sure that you update them with not only, hey, here's the new shots I did, but this may look slightly different because I did it differently this time than my last version.
Yeah.
What do you think? Or I had some issues comping these two plates together, but I tried something different.
Yeah.
Tell me what you think. Because you want to make sure that your editors are aware of how you're thinking and how you're perceiving it, so how you're presenting it to them. So they have some idea of what they're about to look at.
Yeah.
Because if you give them something that's suddenly different than your previous version without any explanation, and we live in a world right now like of chat rooms mm-hmm. a lot of times. So everyone's Slack virtual. And people are on Slack or whatever. So to have more communication of like, I'm sending this to you, looks a little different than last time, but I was trying something new over here, so tell me what you think.
Yeah.
Versus, here's a new comp.
Yeah.
You know, and that has a lot to do with more of that communication and making sure everyone's on the same page, there's no surprises.
But, you know, the other thing is, it occurs to me too, as we're talking about this, we've discussed the sexy part of VFX editing, which is the temp comps. And the thing that I think most people don't realize, certainly people who don't understand what a VFX editor does, and in my opinion, the dominant aspect of what we do, it's shot tracking. And that's where you're going to be using either on shows that have lighter needs, you might use something like Google Docs. And when you get into something that really requires robust tracking, you might be using something like ShotGrid or FileMaker Pro. FileMaker's my preference, you know.
Same. Yeah.
But it's one of those things too. I mean, I think the first time I came into VFX editing, I had no idea what a count sheet is. What was your impression when you came into, I mean, just the paperwork and the tracking, what it is you need to get to a vendor?
Yeah, same. I mean, when I first started, it was as a second assistant editor helping out with VFX
mm-hmm.
and more helping our coordinators spot shots or go through the cut to check what's still in, what's out.
Yeah.
Even though that is the job of the VFX editor, I was just, I can't say exactly at the time, but I was assisting coordinators going through the edit.
And okay.
They were checking things that they needed to check.
Yeah.
Being aware of the database.
Yeah.
Being aware of how it looked, not fully understanding it, because at the time I was assisting where needed, not fully ingratiated into VFX editing.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot when on my feature after that, where I was thrown into the Lion's Den having to take care of VFX editing because they didn't hire anyone.
Okay.
And so that was, hey, talking to a VFX editor I worked with prior, I need, can you give me some tips? Or what is a count sheet? What's a lineup? You know, and even then, for the longest time, count sheet, lineup, they're interchangeable to me.
Yes.
But then you learn as you go on, there's a big difference between a lineup and a count sheet. Count sheet is the sheet that you give the vendor indicating the changes and indicating the counts of the shot,
mm-hmm.
of the frames in your cut and your handles.
Yeah.
And in your original pull. Whereas the lineups are when you line up the versions they've given you with the shots that you have and making sure that they're lined up correctly, and the any notes that you have to give to the vendor to update that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times those lineups are on the count sheet.
The way I've always thought about it is the counts refer to the comp. So if it is a composite shot that has 100 frames, the counts refer to the 100 frames, and the lineup, let's say you're taking two different plates that are 50 frames each and making those two 50 frame shots a 100 frame comp, the lineup would be how plate A and plate B come together to form a 100 frame comp.
Correct. And so while they are interchangeable vernacular, I've noticed myself using count sheets more mm-hmm. than calling them lineups.
Yeah.
And I'm sure more, some veterans would have already come to that place a long time ago, but that's something that as you learn, as you do it more often, you start to understand it more.
Yeah.
And you start to see the differences.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah. And, that kind of leads into the idea of like, when you're talking about how did you start learning some of this stuff? And it came up in conversation recently on some chat groups about PAs and PAs and how we teach them and how we help them grow and how we give what we give them to help them to become assistants or VFX editors or assistant VFX editors, you know?
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I don't know. I've never had an assistant VFX editor. Every VFX editor I've worked with, for the most part, has come in knowing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
For the most, you know, they're worth their salt, and maybe they're not as established, but they understand FileMaker, they understand what a count sheet is, they understand how to check shots, things like that.
Yeah.
Versus I'm teaching someone, and now that's not a PA. That's very different. Two different jobs, clearly.
Yeah.
But that idea of, you know, I've had PAs who are interested in learning, and I have them sit down and tell them, this is how I do a pull. This is how we pull for the vendor. This is my database. This is how I organize shots. This mm-hmm. is how I check my lineups. I check shots and I'm cutting shots in, things like that. But is there anything that you've done in your experience to help PAs learn a bit more than just getting coffee?
You know, the one thing I try to get involved with my PAs is, you know, given the rules of the union, they're not supposed to be touching the Avid. So what I'll do is if I have exported a cut out to, say, Pix or even just a QuickTime, I'll have my PAs update the continuity. That's usually when I'm working as an assistant editor. Just, hey, here's a continuity. Yeah, you can play with that. Just watch this, you know. And, you know, if I need to put approximate scene timings, that's also one of the things. Continuities, whether you have scene timings or not. Okay, yeah, can you just handle that? Wall cards is another thing that can be really handy. Mm-hmm. And so it all, and I always found when I was trying to help a PA learn that stuff, there's a certain amount of control relinquishment that sometimes feels very strange to give up. You know, I worked on a lot of shows where it was just me and my editor and we didn't even have a post PA. So trying to manage that delegation, but also learning to be okay with, I'm going to ask someone to do something and it might not be done exactly the way I want it. And I need to kind, to a certain degree, if it's done drastically, if it's done wrong, I need to say something. But if it's done acceptably, just not the way I might have done it, can I recognize that and also not, and not be nagging, you know? Mm-hmm. But I found wall cards, continuities, those are kind of a nice thing. Within the context of VFX editing, it is different because, to be honest, I'm in a similar boat with you as far as not really having that accessible to me ever since I went into a VFX editor. And, you know, on that note, the distinction between assistant VFX editor and VFX editor, in my experience, anybody who is an assistant VFX editor, it's always, to me, been basically a studio just trying to get a VFX editor but pay them less.
Very true. You don't often find someone entering into the cutting room with no experience.
Yeah.
Or very little assisting experience showing up as an assistant VFX editor.
Yeah.
It is typically they show up as a second assistant editor, or hopefully they can show up as an apprentice and learn from an editor on the job. But typically it's like as an assistant editor on a low budget film.
Yeah.
Or a second assistant on a larger budget film.
Yeah. But you know, the one thing I will say this though about PAs, the one thing I do try to do as often as I can is I try to extend the offer to a PA, which is if you got a little bit of downtime, come into my room. Just sit and watch. If it's a really busy day, I might not be able to stop and answer your questions. But if it isn't a busy day, yeah, you can stop me and go, what did you just do there? And I can go, oh yeah, that's okay. So I'm doing a pull, and a pull means that I'm going to make a sub clip, and that's what's going to go to the vendor. Okay, that's cool, you know. And I for all the times that I've offered that, I've been taken up on it less often than I wish I would have, you know, because I guess from my standpoint, having started in unscripted, but always aspiring to go into films, features, you know, and scripted television, I just remember thinking, God, that'd be so cool. And I get sometimes a little disheartened when I've made an effort. Hey, do you want to do this? You can come into my room. I have an open door policy. And when I sometimes see folks out there watching Netflix, I distinctly remember one post PA on a project that was watching Netflix, and I came out, I think, to get a snack, and they shouted, oh my gosh. And I was like, oh, what happened? Oh, I'm watching this show on Netflix. And in my opinion, that instantly colored my perception of that post PA in terms of, hey, I've offered you the opportunity to learn, and when you have time, you've really squandered that. So now I'm kind of like, well, now I'm really not that inclined to help you. So I'm gonna
huge
move on from that.
Red flag. That's a big no-no. My first internship on a feature, I was an office intern, mm-hmm. getting credit in college.
Yeah.
And I remember coming in, I had my backpack and my books with me for class later, but I also had a book, and I found myself just sitting at the desk, nothing to do.
Yeah.
And this was, you know, social media wasn't a thing yet, so you can't like be on your phone. You had like,
just, was it MySpace? Was it Tom?
Oh yeah, but it wasn't on your phone. You know what I'm saying? So to me, it was like I had a book with me, and I was just reading my book. Mm-hmm. And our APOC came to me and was like, "You can't do that. You can't do that.
You can't read a book."
It was the idea that I am sitting there, I am visible to the whole office, not doing anything. You know what I mean? And I took that as okay. Make sure that you're finding something to do.
But you know,
being productive.
Now
there's a difference, and I hear you, because there's a difference between nothing's going on, that's fine.
Yeah.
Versus you're the you don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're the young kid, and you think that you can just sit there and because no one's telling you what to do.
Yeah.
It's your job to find out what can be done.
Yeah.
Offering yourself up.
Yeah.
You know, and finding the work as well. Because while it wasn't a train, I'm getting school credit for it.
Yeah.
And was I getting paid? No, I wasn't. I was getting school credit. And so I guess what I just took from that was not that you can't do that, mm-hmm. but more of a, in this situation, you're here to learn and you're here to take it all in. You're not here to sit and read a book. And in your case, if that person's getting paid.
Yeah.
And while we all know that we've had busy days and we've had slow days.
Yeah.
But when you're the PA, it can look bad if you are being seen as someone who is just waiting around for someone to tell you what to do.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I depending on the position, because there are circumstances where there is nothing. All the snacks are stocked, all of the office supplies are there, and you've offered your service and there's nothing. So I don't think people should pretend to be busy for the benefit of a supervisor, but I do think in the position of somebody of a position that is really there to move up, it begs the now, and I think where a little bit of nuance enters this discussion is there are people who are not receptive to teaching, and I've encountered this more than I care to say, but I have noticed there are assistant editors and editors alike who I think like the idea of being a mentor more than they actually like being a mentor, mm-hmm. only because I've been in those situations where I've asked people, hey, you know, if we have a little bit of downtime, can I watch? And I've been point blank told no in the past. So in a circumstance where if you have been shut down in that sense, you know.
Well, yeah, and that's a different story. If you are trying and nothing's there for you.
But okay. I do think, you know, by and large, on a production, on a TV show, you probably have 2 to 3 editorial teams. There's probably somebody you can cozy up to. Hopefully not all 3 teams are dismissive.
Right. And it is the nature of working on bigger projects when there's almost like the work is so divided up.
Yeah.
That there are plenty of people to get the work done.
Yeah.
So it can feel at times that everyone's caught up and there really isn't much for the PA to help with.
Yeah.
That is within their job description.
Yeah.
But on a smaller project, you can find that being in very low budget film, mm-hmm. where you don't have the money to have a nice fancy studio space.
Yeah.
You have one office.
Yeah.
Where you're all kind of like huddled together.
Yeah.
Doing the work. You learn a lot more because you're in the room. Mm-hmm. You know, the jobs I've had where I had to share, even as an assistant, where I've had to share a room with an editor,
mm-hmm.
man, you learn a lot because you're like side by side the entire time. And that's very similar to how it used to be, where an assistant really was in the room with the editor. Yeah. I'm here to assist you physically. And I think in a way, PAs can help that, but it can be boring times,
you know,
and when there's really nothing to do. And I don't really, you know, I know as a PA, like I want to help and I want to learn, but I'm also like, I'm not doing it, so I don't feel like I'm learning anything if I can't do it.
Yeah. But, and you know, to your point about being in the room, there is an interesting counterpoint that I noticed, particularly as far as remote work goes, because I know a lot of people have said within remote, it's much harder to learn. And yet I will say the one thing that has been really valuable for me with remote work was because when the pandemic happened, Marvel, She-Hulk was one of the first shows I did via remote. And I noticed one thing, which was since everything was being done via Zoom, I was getting invited into meetings that I feel like I normally wouldn't have been invited into. Because when you're sitting with the editor, you are limited by the physical space of the room. And of course, the top executives, they're priority number one, followed by the director, few of the producers and VFX supervisor or whoever's working with the editor while they're working. And I found there was a lot of meetings that they would just put me in, and it was really valuable for me to see how so many of these people think and how they're trying to guide the story, that there was a lot to be learned. And so it's at the same time, not being in the room with people, it is a different dynamic, but I will, it's kind of one of those areas why I actually think there's a lot of benefit from remote work, in that there's just like there's creative discussions that half the times as VFX editors we're just not a part, because that's mm-hmm. that is for the VFX supervisor, that's for the coordinators to disseminate notes to the vendors. And it's kind of cool to go, oh, okay, that's what this person's preferences are, this is what the dynamic of the story they're trying to tell. And I find for me that informs me, for example, if I have an idea of what our showrunner really wants creatively, and I'm creating a temp comp that might inform, you know, something about this is the character's weakness. So when I do this temp comp, the character has to be doing this. And if it's like a laser blast that's coming onto them or something, okay, I need to make sure that this character who is weak to this kind of a thing, and this is, you know, I'm just using that as a generic example. Yeah. I think there's a lot of value.
You have more insight to this, to not even just the story, but what the showrunner wants.
Yeah.
And that can help for sure. And it's also just being aware of what the thought process is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you hear something after the fact and you're like, why did they change this?
Yeah.
It was working.
Yeah.
And you find out, oh, well, because of these reasons over here that you weren't even privy to, they can't do the thing they wanted to do. Now they have to change everything.
Yeah.
You know? And when it comes to PAs, I think that the best thing that a young person can do is to make sure that you are ready and available to assist when needed and ask questions as much as you can. Mm-hmm. But also don't be a PA that long.
Yes.
That's one thing I've seen. I've seen people who struggled because they were maybe, and part of it was during the pandemic when there wasn't maybe just the nature of things, just being on a series where a show one season rolls to another and the PA just stays on when normally they would have left to go to a different show or job. So that would be my biggest recommendation to young people. If you're just starting out looking for work, PA one or two jobs and then get onto something as an assistant editor, low budget, non-union stuff, and start earning your hours and meeting people and getting people to see you as an assistant editor.
Yeah.
And then you can make your way up.
Yeah, because I recognize that I've fallen victim to the same issue of when you see people in the same job, they reach back out and we don't need to post PA anymore, and I'm an assistant editor now. And I think that's by taking the initiative to step up and reestablish themselves, you know, that's also a valuable thing, you know, for all of us. And but when you keep on returning to the same pattern, there is like, okay, so yeah, you've been this for 3-4 years.
What is the reason that you haven't moved up yet?
I say that without judgment, because there are a variety of paths one might go. For example, as a post PA, maybe you don't want to be an editor, and that's fine. Maybe you want to go into post management, so your goal is to become a coordinator, then a post supervisor, then a producer or whatnot. Totally fine, totally viable paths. But you know what is the goal? Because I find for myself, generally, if it's a person who is of a personality that I like and want to help out, it's like, well, I want to help you out, but I'm not going to throw you for an assistant editor job if that's not what you want to do. But also, I would say though, for veterans, for us working in the field, I've heard counterpoints about this. You know, I want to help people who have the initiative to ask me for help, and I think there is some truth to that. But I also think we should also be open with our doors too. We should, hey, do you want to learn this? Well, cool. You should come on by. And if they don't take you up, they don't take you up. But I also, I don't think it should be solely on the person with the least power to go, hey, person with 20 years of experience, I want to be in your room. You know, I think it's a mutual one. As a young person coming into the field, you should have initiative. And as a veteran who's been doing it for a long time, you should also recognize you were there at one point. Give me a little hand.
I mean, that's all what we're doing. This is a trade.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways, it's a craft. So you're teaching others and helping others, and, you know, you got to give a little to get a little.
Yeah.
You know, it's passing it forward. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I think in the end, that helps everyone.
Indeed, yeah.
So let's switch subjects a little bit, wrap it up here. The something else we wanted to talk about was union benefits.
Yeah.
And
the perception of what the union does. There was a discussion I saw a while ago, and they were really angry that the union doesn't find you work. And just so when we say the union, there's three unions that I can think about that represent editors. The primary union, what most people refer to when they say the union with air quotes, is IATSE, and in our case, Motion Picture Editors Guild. Whether you're in New York or in Los Angeles, you'll be working under Local 700. There's also NABIT, which handles broadcast, and the IBEW, which handles a small select of editors. But when we say the union, we're talking about IATSE. And I know some people were expressing discontent that the union doesn't find work for you and for those who are not in the union, and think that the union does not find you work. But I would argue that's probably a pretty good thing, because if the union had a traditional hiring hall, people like me with 15 years of experience would be getting work before somebody with no experience would. And I think there's a lot of cons to that kind of situation. Is if the union was to find you work, there are probably going to be provisions that would be detrimental to new folks. And I think it also allows a lot more cross-pollination with crews in terms of, I met this guy, Steve. He's really cool. I want to get him on my team. Cool. And I can then say, hey, I want to offer you a job because I have an opening. And it wouldn't have to come down to, well,
I can't hire you because I'm told that I have to hire Joe.
Yeah, you only have 11 years of experience and somebody else who has 13 just came by.
And if so it's based on experience, who gets first, then there no one would ever be able to learn and move up. Yeah. I hear you. But should the union be able to offer what productions are available for you to contact?
I think that would be a valuable thing, you know, and it really, it comes down to productions don't typically want to advertise themselves to the union, particularly if they're non-union, because they're hoping that shows don't go union. I recognize that. But I also, you know, my view, and maybe I'm being overly quixotic about this, is I think that we offer a mutual benefit to each other. The union has a responsibility to make sure our members are of the highest standard, to provide the highest service to the studios. And part of that contract then is this is the pay rate that we demand, you know. So I think that... in an ideal world, it would be a good thing that productions would always advertise themselves to the union, and then the union would provide valuable members to them. But I recognize that there's a lot of productions that would rather just avoid union attention.
Yeah. When I was younger, I remember going to the New York office, looking, saying, I'm trying to, like, I need a job.
Yeah.
You know, and just being desperate and be like walking in. And they were offering up the Production Weekly report.
Mm-hmm.
And but they said, oh, no, you can't make a copy of it. You got to. Here's pen and paper. You can write stuff down. I'm like, okay. And it was very disheartening.
Yeah.
Because it felt like I didn't really have anyone to help.
Yeah.
But they still offered something. And I don't know if they still have the Production Weekly report.
You know, I don't ever recall seeing a Production Weekly report.
Production Weekly. This is a long time ago, but they would have, like, here's the pages and pages of productions in production or in post or in prep, as they were willing to dispense the information.
Sounds like the below the line listings, and also IMDb Pro that offers some of that information.
Yeah, Production Weekly, I think. Productionweekly.com. Yeah. They still have it. Okay, it still exists. And that's something you can go to find out what productions are happening in your area, and if they're in production or pre-production or post-production. And typically they could tell you who's already on the job, maybe if it's director or producer, editor perhaps.
Yeah.
And that could be a way to reach out to someone to see if you can get on it. But you got to remember that a lot of people, like we talk about, we hire who we know and who we're already familiar with.
Yeah.
And so that can be difficult to be a random hire.
Yeah.
Unless there's particular, I don't want to say the stars align, but when the circumstances are such that they need someone and you're available.
Yeah.
You know, someone else who were able to get you to that person.
Yeah.
But Production Weekly is a good way to start. But yeah, I remember going to the union and then saying, well, here's the printout. Takes notes. I'm like, okay. And it's like 5-10 pages. I'm like, all right, what, you know, it can be difficult. But to your point, if the union was to just be giving out jobs, then that can cause a lot of problems as well for those who don't get those jobs.
Yeah.
So then some unions would have like a hiring hall, but in this case, just being able to get the work on your own does help working with people you know that work well with you and your team. What kind of like successes have you seen with the union versus without?
I mean, you know, since I started in Unscripted, and at the time, almost all Unscripted was non-union, a lot of the successes I'd seen were Unscripted shows going union and getting people benefits and getting them healthcare. And I have walked several picket lines with those people. And I recognize it's a scary thing. A lot of people working non-union have been of the opinion, I don't want to rock the boat. This company keeps me working all year round, and I don't want to be seen as a troublemaker. And I get that, but there is something to be said about you're getting health care, you're getting pension hours, and I think it's pretty valuable. I've also found that most people I know that have been in that situation have come around to tell me that I was really terrified and I thought the company would hate me and not hire me anymore. And I think they might be sore for a little while, but they generally will recognize you've been editing with us for years, and we're not gonna kick you out of our Rolodex because you went union. You're too valuable to us. You know what you're doing, and it's okay. We got to pay you a little bit more, and we have to pay your fringes. And in general, I feel like I can't think of too many circumstances where somebody has gone union and they folded. I'm not going to say that hasn't happened, because I know it absolutely has. And I feel like I can feel the scrutiny of people right now listening to this going, no. And I to whomever you are saying that to me right now, 100%, I will not deny your story, because I know that's happened. Mm-hmm. But I think there is, because again, I believe in the mutual benefit of the worker to the boss. And I've seen a lot of people's work conditions increase quite a bit by standing and saying, we want a contract.
And what kind of flaws would you say there would be from being union?
I mean, I don't even know that flaw is the right word, but I think perceptions versus reality is the thing. And I think a big part of that is because I was under the impression that once I started working union, I would work union for forever and ever. And, you know, it took me a while to establish myself with union jobs and people who work in the union regularly. So I think recognizing that the structure of the union is imperfect. I also thought when you had a union contract, nobody would dare mess with you. Everyone knows overtime has to be paid for. But I quickly learned, oh no, just because you have a union contract that protects you doesn't mean that people won't try to get away with it. And hey, can you just stay and work 15 more minutes? But we don't want a meal penalty. We don't want, no, don't put it on your time card. It's only 10 minutes. It's only 15 minutes. And I always find that I'm kind of in this mind space of like, look, if you ask me for 10 minutes, I'm probably not going to bust your chops about it. But when you ask for 10 minutes six times, now that's an hour, and that's an hour I should be paid for. So I think being cognizant to know, I think there is a time to be a chum about things, and I think there's a time to go, I have a contract that protects against this, and now you are starting to stretch that. So you're going to let me off early, because I've given you this time, or you need to start paying me for this. And it is, we have to assert ourselves, and that's scary. But I also think there are better and worse ways to assert yourself. I think it's important to, it looks very romantic in some TV show, you know, where someone says, I'm not taking this. I'm gonna, you can't do this. I'm the, and that's not going to be a good way to get the result you want. I think I always approach things, for example, when OT is coming up, you know, when you're under an intense deadline and you go, hey, I'm going to go into OT in about 15 minutes. And what you just asked me to do, it's about an hour's worth of work. So I'll tell you what, can I finish this in the morning? Otherwise, I need approval for overtime.
And half the time you say that, they'll be like, all right, just do it tomorrow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
because you realize a lot of people are asking for things they don't really know what they're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, when do you need it by?
Yeah.
They say, I just need it now. I'm like, well, when do you really need it by? Well, tomorrow afternoon. All right, so I can do it in the morning.
Which illuminates the fact that sometimes it isn't necessarily even malice on a studio's part that they're asking you for something. It's simply, they're asking you for something that they didn't realize. That's a big ask, and that's going to take a lot of time. And they'll say, yeah, knock it out in the morning.
Yeah.
Or, that this is a really important cut. Yes, we need this.
And a lot of people, it's a world of go, go, go.
Yeah.
I need it now, I need it now, I need it yesterday, right?
Yeah.
So that's typical to get asked, being given a request to say, I need it now, I need it right away. But in reality, when do you really need it?
Yeah.
Gauge your own sense of work and your own balance of how long do you have to get it done? How long do you know it takes to get done?
Yeah.
And when does it really need to get done by?
Yeah.
And that can help you not be forced to work the overtime.
Exactly.
If they don't need it, because half the time you end up working it just to come in the next day and no one ever watched that cut you exported.
Yeah.
When you stayed late to get it out the door because everyone thought it was so important.
Yeah.
And then no one watched it. So, because, oh, yeah, it's not till 5 o'clock. I'm like, you told me to stay late last night.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
And then I guess last, overall effects of work-life balance pre and post-union. Anything that you see that's like when you were non-union versus union?
I mean, you basically hit the nail on the head when you were talking about the amount of time in terms of, I can think back to working non-union and staying until 4 a.m. and feeling like I was a hero. And the one thing I didn't realize at the time that I realize now is unless there is an executive waiting at 4 a.m. to receive the cut, meaning they will be watching the cut until 5 a.m, unless that is the truth, there's no reason for you to stay that late.
100%.
But working non-union, when people will generally work you overtime and not pay you for it at all, I found that I had zero work-life balance. Just relaying one story, and this is a true story. I remember at the time I was working in Santa Monica and I lived in Arcadia, which for folks who don't know the Los Angeles area, it's maybe only a 15-mile drive, but in Los Angeles, that is about 1 hour to 1 hour 10. And so I worked a job. I had pulled back to back like maybe 3 or 4 16-hour days and I was on the night shift. And I remember I was driving down the 10 freeway and I dozed off. And I don't know if I specifically fell asleep or if I was there but just not thinking in any way, shape, or form. And I kind of came back to a sense of consciousness on a completely different freeway. I was on the 710 South. I know I sound like that SNL sketch right now.
It's okay.
But
that's where we live.
But I was like, how the heck did I get here? And for everybody who's been put in a dangerous situation and not lived through it, because that has certainly happened, I felt this sense of, this is not healthy. This is not okay. And I have found, since going union, those kinds of days, not that they don't happen, but they have been far fewer. They have been fewer and far between, and you have certain protections in place. For example, the one thing, and it does bug me that the rule is you have to ask for it, but if you are worked excessive hours, you can request your production to be given a hotel room so you don't have to have a dangerous drive.
But you got to ask for it.
You do have to
ask
for it.
No one's going to just tell you this. It's what you get.
And it is a shame that that is written into the contractual language that you have to request it. And even that represents the conflict that a lot of union members have is, I feel if I ask for this thing, which you are contractually guaranteed, but if I ask for it, I'm going to be putting a target on my back.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize the concern there, but at the same time, there is something to be said. You know, I was thinking back to a speech that Kamala Harris was giving recently where she said, courage is contagious. And I do find within your crew, mm-hmm. I'm sure if you're feeling this way, you're not the only member on your crew feeling that way. And you can say, hey, I'm exhausted. I need that hotel room. And you're probably going to have 3 or 4 people raising their hands going, oh, yeah, us too. So you don't need to feel alone, that you can be singled out.
So how many years are you vested in the union?
I believe I am 14 years vested.
Hey, me too.
Yeah.
Look at that.
See?
And I would say we probably had the same amount of time, where about 3 to 4 years where it was a little rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it started to trickle in and become steady.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody who's looking to join the union, just know that there may be some maybe rough at the beginning to get people to be aware of you as a union worker.
Yes.
But trust that it will get better and you will find yourself in the mix of everyone else and hoping to start get those benefits and get those get the perks of being in the union, whether it's work-life balance and health and safety or not getting overworked and also pension benefits and better pay.
Yeah, and you know, and the roll up to a career based upon relationships, it takes time. And the one thing you cannot force relationships. You have to simply give them time. And that's what it is. gaining that momentum to work in the union. You're going to build relationships with people working union. And I think there's something to be said. When I went from unscripted to scripted, I had the false pretense that I would never work unscripted again and I would work scripted forever from that point on. And my first scripted job was not followed by my second scripted job. And the same thing happened with my first union job. My first union job was not followed by my second. And that's okay. You ping pong for a little bit, you meet more people. But again, you can't force it, so I don't recommend you force it, but you meet people and you also discover who you like, because maybe your first few union experiences you might be working with people who you're not the personalities to work together. That's fine, you have it, and guess what, you're gonna have those throughout your career. It is what it is. But you find the people you like, and once you lock on to those people, this is someone I want to spend time with. So you catch up with them. Hey, let's get a beer, let's get a coffee. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So in the end, it's all about relationships.
That's it.
Yeah. So everyone out there, keep sticking with it. Good luck to you. And reach out to us if you have any questions. RenderBarPod@gmail.com. I'm Steve.
I'm Richard.
And this is the Render Bar. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.
If you have a question or a topic that you'd like to hear us discuss on the Render Bar, feel free to reach out to us at our email at RenderBarPod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.